Hello, beloved listeners. Welcome to another hour of Advanced Living Radio. My name's Kenneth Lesser, and I'm thrilled and delighted to be your host again today. Yes. And you know, every day I have a prayer that helps guide me. It goes, Heavenly Father, show me the best ways to have the most fun, inspiring the largest number of people to easily, naturally, joyously experience vibrantly, exquisitely, healthy, wealthy, passionate living in the shortest amount of time with the least intrusion into their lives so we can all get our needs met and celebrate a global loving community that works for everyone. Yeah, take that in and, oh boy, let's go for it. Right, I've done my best to cover all the bases there in just a simple sentence, and we are devoted to that cause, and I think it resonates with all of us because we're all trying to get our needs met, and we all really, when we're feeling good, we have the energy to care about those around us, and so we're in for a big treat today, folks. Before we get started, I want to invite you to notice that our show is sponsored by AdvancedLiving.com. The home of the comfort technology. It's a Clark Kent clock with superpowers. Yes, it's a stylish digital clock that you can use to tell what time it is and travel with it and put it on your desk or by your nightstand. But when you plug it in, it creates a harmonized energy like having the Dalai Lama show up and meditate in your room. It is so sweet. Mitigates the electromagnetic stress we live in. Helps raise the healing field of energy. Check it out. Go to AdvancedLiving.com. All right, folks. Well, you're wondering what would be helpful. Well, I have a guest today, and we made a comment. We said the most loving conspiracy, because we keep hearing about conspiracy theories and evil people and behind-the-scenes stuff. Well, how about a loving conspiracy? Well, it is being led by this guy, Michael Ortiz Hill. And he talks about conspiracies of kindness. Ah, talk about someone with a brash sense of where is this guy coming from, of all the things to conspire about. He must have heard of the Dalai Lama who's said, "If you above all things, please practice kindness." Oh, yeah. Okay, well, we're going to hear him, and he's going to be talking to us about a book, The Craft of Compassion. Yes, I know, it's not like, yes, there's Michael's craft store, you know, where you can go and do arts and crafts and hobby stuff. Well, this is another Michael, but his craft is about the craft of compassion. And you're wondering, what? Well, who is this guy? Well, let me tell you. Michael Ortiz Hill is a registered nurse. He's a Buddhist practitioner. He has been initiated as a medicine man with the tribal people of Zimbabwe. And the core of his spiritual practice has been the refinement and activity of compassion, which he has learned as a hospice worker, a UCLA Medical Center float nurse for 10 years, meaning that doesn't mean he just floats, you know, like on the water. He actually goes around to different places is what float nurse means. And as an earthquake relief worker at El Salvador, and by traveling to Vietnam with American veterans for peacemaking and healing. And he's the author of the newly released book, The Craft of Compassion at the Bedside of the Ill. And, oh my gosh, we're just going to love hearing from him today. And this book has been highly praised by many medical doctors and nurses and hospice workers and clergy and us good old folks. They call us lay people because sometimes we get so tired they have to lay us down. And then he's also the author of Dreaming the End of the World, Apocalypse as a Rite of Passage, and then Twin from Another Tribe, the story of two shamanic healers in Africa, North America, and the Village of the Water Spirits, the dreams of African Americans. And oh my gosh, this man is just amazing, and he self-healed himself from multiple sclerosis. He currently leads workshops and gives lectures on the craft of compassion. He lives in Topanga in California with his wife and author Dina Metzger. So, folks, welcome on board Michael Ortiz Hill. Hello, Michael.
Well, hello, Kenneth. That is quite an introduction. I hope I can live up to it.
Well, anyone that can float as a nurse certainly can do an amazing interview, so.
Okay. Yes, floating is, it definitely takes a certain talent.
I bet. Now, I shared a little bit about your background. I don't know if you'd want to do anything, add anything more about, you know, healing world as a nurse, you know, where you, what your current activities are focused on.
Yeah, you were pretty thorough. I can't quite think of anything. I'm grandfather, but I don't know if that's particularly irrelevant.
Okay.
I just had my grandson almost a year ago, and I became a grandfather at the ripe old age of 32 because my wife's 20 years older than myself, so her son. I have a couple of teenage granddaughters. And
fantastic.
It is quite fantastic, completely.
So you're kind of bridging multi-generational gaps. Right?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I've been with my wife for 23 years now.
Ah. That's fantastic. Now, these books that you've written, I'm curious what led you to the subject of this particular latest book, The Craft of Compassion at the Bedside of the Ill.
Well, you know, I open up the book, let's see how to put it all in a nutshell. I was homeless for 3 years as a teenager, and those 3 years I bottomed out, of course, profoundly. And my father bottomed out. He was an alcoholic, and he drank himself to death when he was slightly younger than I am now. And there was basically, when I was on the street, there was a woman, Kelsey Ramage, who I've come to think of Saint Kelsey. She's still around. She would work in a local bookstore, and she'd pass me on the street at the time where I felt like I had fallen through the net. I'd fallen through the web. I was no longer among the human community. And she'd simply say good morning to me, and I'd say good morning to her. And that was the whole of it. And that was the thread that kept me from falling utterly through the web and not returning. And I recognized that no act of kindness, however small, is insignificant. And when I was reconstituting myself, I committed myself to learning what compassion is and how one moves with it. And I did go into, left the street. My daughter was born around the time my father died. And I worked in hospice for 3 years and then decided I would become an RN. So that's the ground of it all, you know.
Oh, okay. Wow. And so with all of those things, it's really helped you to see from the downside the power of a kind word or a gesture.
Exactly.
Yes, I know one of the things that I like to do, a lot of people, if you walk down the street or you're in a store or something, and you happen to spot a penny, it's like, oh, there's a sign of good luck. Look, it sounds the money. Now, you know, you're not going to buy the ranch or retire on that, but it's sort of like, oh, here's some positive energy.
Yeah.
And so one of the things that I like to do, I said I've discovered how I can make 100 people feel better for a dollar.
Uh-huh.
And the way I can make 100 people feel better for a dollar is by getting a roll of pennies and then spreading them out as I go through different days. And, of course, as I go different places, I like to make sure they're heads up. So those that are superstitious will like that even better.
That's entirely brilliant. I might plagiarize you on that one.
Well, just give me credit so that people know where that came from, because I want more folks out there doing that, Michael. Because that's a simple act of kindness, and literally you can make 100 people feel better for a dollar.
That's remarkable.
So, this is the kind of thing that, you know, is your specialty in what you're talking about. Mm-hmm. You know, folks, you know, be mindful, because Michael and I want you to be thinking about what little things that you can do. And I don't know if you're doing any blogging or have ways that people can perhaps email you, because you could be a resource, like a kindness or a compassion center, where people could share other little things, just like I've shared my idea with you.
Yeah. Well, I have a blog, which I've hardly ever tended to, I confess, and I have a website, michaelortizhill.com, and I have an email, which you can get from my website, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, this is, and I hope I'm not being too elliptical from responding to what you were saying, the smallness of the gesture. The third, I speak of the craft of compassion as four steps. Self-compassion, compassion for others, radical empathy, and then living compassion. And radical empathy, I tell a story of working on oncology, the cancer ward at UCLA Medical Center. And I had a patient who was actually, the thing about radical empathy, I should say right away, is it's about seeing through another's eyes. It's about putting yourself to the side and seeing through another's eyes. The Cherokee proverb, you can only understand another when you've walked 3 moons in their moccasins. That's the idea of radical empathy. I had this patient. She was actually exactly the age of my daughter then, and she had on her bedside table, she had some pictures of herself performing Midsummer's Night Dream. She was a young actress, as was my daughter. And she had leukemia, and she had stem cell therapy, and she was asleep. I had given her earlier a little Ativan to let her sleep, and her lips were, you know, bleeding effectively because stem cell transplants, the first thing you do is you eliminate the immune system of the patient and replace it with new stem cells. At any rate, that's the medical background. But I came in and I brought, and her father was at the bedside, brought him a cup of coffee, and I said to him quietly, I said, my daughter is her age. And that was sufficient. There was this knowing glance between the two of us. And that was the radiant truth of compassion in that moment. And that was seeing his situation with his daughter through the eyes of having a daughter who was an actress the age of his daughter. And there was that element of just solidarity, you know, at that point.
Boy, talk about some instant bonding.
Instant, yeah, quite.
Mm. Yeah. Yes, and what a simple way. Talking, because the theme is about the work that you're doing with compassion,
exactly.
To be able to share with someone that you can relate personally to where they're at, that is a very strong act of compassion, isn't it?
Profoundly so, and that's the step two, the craft of compassion, compassion for others. I work from the Buddha's definition of compassion, which he said was sympathetic joy, joy over another's joy, and sympathetic sorrow, sorrow over another's sorrow. And I was speaking in L.A. here to the L.A. Jung Institute about the craft of compassion, and I started speaking of my new grandson, you know, and what it was to have a grandson, little Shiloh, you know, who's born laughing, as I put it. And I looked over the audience, and there was a lightening up. I mean, the sympathetic joy was palpable. And then I told the story of my little brother, Paul, who was psychotic and wandered into the forest in New Mexico and disappeared there and was gone for 4 years until we discovered his remains. A deer hunter found his skeleton. And we didn't know whether he was dead or alive. And I told this story, and I could see also palpable the sympathetic sorrow. And I said, that is the essence of the Buddha's teaching of compassion, what I've seen in you, the joy over my grandson and the sorrow over the loss of my brother, you know. And that's the gist of it. So I have people, when I teach compassion, to gather the stories of the joy of their joy and the sorrow of their sorrow, with which they meet another's joy and another's sorrow, because that's medicine. That is the power of compassion.
Mm. Yeah. Oh, that's wonderful. And to me, I so appreciate the focus of attention that you're calling forth.
Yeah.
Because when we look at typically what's on TV or in the news, we're being asked and are invited or drugged in some way into resonating with drama, with confusion, with betrayal, with revenge.
Yeah,
and by empathizing and relating to those things, we certainly don't end up more compassionate.
No, hardly.
You know?
Quite the opposite.
Yeah. So to me, it's like you're talking about some very important truths about our ability to resonate with something that's presented to us, and then the importance of of being selective about what we allow to be presented to us. Because
okay.
if it's the joy, if it's the a sorrow that we can relate to with each other, then we can come to a place of this compassion.
Yeah.
Oh, this is great. And now people can order your book from the Michael Hill or MichaelOrtizHill.com.
Yeah, or directly from Amazon.
Okay,
or Barnes & Noble, either one. Yeah.
Okay. Very good.
I'm thinking of there is a poem by William Blake. He says, "Joy and woe are woven fine, the clothing of the soul divine." Everybody carries joy and woe. That is the clothing of the soul divine. You know, that is, unfortunately, we live in a culture that rejects sorrow as if it were dismissible, which obviously it isn't, but people try to dismiss it, and that itself generates a lot of denial and, in fact, a lot of suffering. How does one work with one's sorrow in order to meet another sorrow or the sorrow of the world with compassion? You know, that is the transformation of sorrow, and that is that is the nature of spiritual liberation.
And these are some of the things that that you address, because you're bringing up something very important, that sometimes when people are hurting, being in denial about it or wanting to make light of it rather than to actually feel it, because, my gosh, if you feel it, well, people might reject you or make fun of you.
Yeah, well, exactly. Yeah.
And are there some hints that that you put forward in your book that you can share, one or two of something with people, of how to be able to make a breakthrough into being able to deal with this and know that they're not going to go into the deep end of endless crying for 300 years? Or
yeah. Oh, my. Well, I do, again, step number one is self-compassion, and that is the ground of compassion. And I do speak of my own recovery from being homeless, because I had seriously bottomed out when I was homeless. And my spiritual practice for a few years was just learning what gratitude was. I was a housewife, so to speak. I was a high school dropout. My wife was a school teacher, and she would go to work, and I would take care of the baby. And at the end of the day, I would write 10 things I was grateful for. A beautiful sunset, my daughter's smile. I mean, just, you know, so-called little things like that, you know. And I entered into the habit of gratitude. And that is the core of self-compassion, being grateful for simply being alive. You mentioned in passing my passage through multiple sclerosis, and I did lose my job as a floor nurse simply because I couldn't walk. I could walk, but I couldn't walk functionally enough to rush around in the corridors of a hospital. And that was so much about self-compassion also. The Latin word is amor fati, to love one's fate. Not what you've chosen, but what has been chosen for you. This set of parents, this race, this history, you know. Not what you've made of yourself, but what you have to, well, in fact, what you have to praise. And multiple sclerosis, I called the guest because I made an alliance with the spirit of multiple sclerosis. My healing of MS was through what in Zimbabwe they call sacred illness. Multiple sclerosis had come to teach me, and I had to receive it and listen to its teachings. So that's core. And Amor Fati, to love one's fate, to speak and feel the gratitude for being alive is fundamental. That is step one of the four steps.
Okay. Yeah, that's interesting. That when you think of gratitude, you as a nurse, here's an invitation for you, Mike. I'm being guided to offer you something, and you may be able to make use of this in your work.
Go for it.
Because with the idea of gratitude, and with your background in nursing and knowing our physiology,
mm-hmm. yeah.
There's times myself and maybe others out there have mm-hmm. just thought, this place that I'm in, this planet, where's the right planet? Why'd you drop me here, this life? I don't think I'm too interested in it. It ain't working. It doesn't feel good. Ask me to be, grateful and what I'm thinking to myself here and being glad to invite you to consider is our body. So I'm thinking to myself, okay, in the midst of no matter how down I've been, I'm still alive, so I know that there were some things that went on. For instance, how many times did my heart beat that day in the midst of no matter how bad I felt? How many breaths did I take? Those are two more obvious things.
Mm-hmm.
There's an unknown group of people that I'm making this up. I better tell people in advance so they won't go out and do this. That super glued their eyelids open.
Oh, Lord.
Just so they wouldn't miss anything.
Right.
And of course, as I've warned you, this is not true. This is just a, don't do this at home, folks, even if you have the super glue. It's not worth it.
Definitely not.
Anyway.
Wouldn't recommend it.
Anyway, no. but we blink and we don't even think that there is a lot of importance to the regular blinking that we do.
Absolutely.
So there's the breathing, the beat of our heart, and then, thousands, I guess, upon thousands of different mm-hmm. things that take place for us, sustaining us, even if we're not having a good day, even if we're not doing a good diet, even if we haven't exercised in 42 years. A lot of these things are still going on, and if someone says, I don't know if I got anything to be grateful for, I think you could whip out a list on them that would knock them over.
Yeah. I mean, exactly. Begin with one's breath.
mm-hmm.
Brother Stendhal Rost, the Benedictine monk, he talks about the gift nature of everything. And as a profound monk, everything comes as gift. I mean, the rising of the sun, whatever. Everyone you meet, it's a gift. And I did receive the multiple sclerosis as a gift. And it was. I consider MS as the great gift of my adult life, really. It completely transformed me. And when I work with people, very often as a Nanga medicine man or as a nurse, I will say, well, what have you learned from your AIDS or your cancer or whatever that you could not have learned any other way? And to approach them with that open-ended question, and they go for it. They really ponder, and the questions are invariably, the answers are really, it's answered from a profound place because they've had no one to share that with.
Wow. That's excellent. Now, there's a doctor that I met recently actually June of last year, Dr. Larry Dossey.
Oh, yes.
Renowned medical doctor.
And
he has been kind enough to review your work,
and he
writes about your book. He says, this luminous book can change your life.
Oh, yeah.
Now, that's fantastic.
Oh, very much so. Bless Larry.
Can you expand on that a little bit and kind of...
That'd change life?
What he meant by that?
Well, how do you say? I speak of compassion as effectively the liberation of the soul. Every gesture of compassion is a freeing up of one's own soul. And that's how it transforms your life. And that has been, I mean, as I was saying about my experience having been homeless and stepping into living the practice of compassion. The Greek myth, I have too many languages in my brain, so
most of our listeners today, Michael, are going to hear in English, and we...
Well, no.
We don't have the translators tuned in yet.
Well, I can speak English, too, occasionally.
All right, okay.
Yeah, the Greek, the idea of craft, I draw from the work of Dr. James Hillman, who's a post-Jungian therapist, and he talks about the metaphor of, in ancient Greece, of the bees would make soul. The idea that soul was not, you didn't come born with a soul, you had to make it. And so the bees make the honeycombs and put honey in each of the combs. And so the diligence of the practice of compassion is making honeycombs. So you put in the sweetness of your transformation. So there's the activity. I do emphasize in the book that compassion is an activity. It's not about a feeling, you know. It's about an activity. I do tell one story about this man who was a patient of mine, and he had pancreatic cancer, and he knew he was terminal. And he had worked in the Manhattan Project, developing the first atomic bomb, was a chemist. He was a chemist. And he ultimately said, why am I here? You know, I'm a chemist. I'm not a physicist. So they sent him to Tennessee to work on biological weaponry. And he spent decades, his whole professional life was creating weapons of mass destruction. You mentioned my first book, Dreaming the End of the World. The first three or four chapters are about the Manhattan Project. And so initially he was very charming, and I was wanting to get the skinny, you know, on Oppenheimer and Szilard and Teller and all these people I'd written about. I wanted to hear what the gossip was. And we talked about that, and then I left and to tent with my other patients, and I felt hugely ambivalent. This man had spent his life making weapons of mass destruction. And I found my own judgment immense in me. And, and I didn't care whether he lived or died at that point. I mean, I felt nothing but contempt. And at one point, 2 a.m, the call light goes off, and I go in there, and he's in excruciating pain, and he's woken up in a panic because he knows he's going to die, and he says he's been waking up this way every night lately. And I turn around, and I go get a little morphine sulfate for his pain, and I sat at his bedside, and I held his hand, and I injected the morphine into his IV line slowly. And I just sat with him for 20 minutes silently. And I realized my judgments mean nothing. We do not choose who we are to be compassionate to. We don't, you know. And, I mean, I would prefer that he spend his life slinging tofu burgers, you know. But that was his life. And he knew that he was coming to the end. He was facing the abyss that would swallow him. And it was for me just to sit silent with him those 20 minutes or so until he fell asleep. But that's what I'm saying. Compassion is an activity. It is not a feeling. Feeling compassion can be a lovely thing. It can also be very narcissistic, you know. Thump one's chest, I am Mr. Compassion. I mean, and I've done that, which is, I won't curse, but BS, I guess, is how you, nice little abbreviation. Yeah, but how does one meet whatever one is called to meet, or whoever one is called to meet?
And what do you think helped you? Because you're telling us the story of this man, and you knew about him, and were certainly much less than thrilled about how he had spent his life, and what it, you know, that had cost in terms of number of lives on the planet.
Yeah.
And so, to me, I think there's just in that whole thing. I mean, for me, Michael, I don't know about the rest of folks out there, but I have been upset more than once, maybe even more than twice, about the state of affairs in the world and the corporate leaders that are, if they were went in for a psychiatric evaluation, some of the way these corporations are run, it's like they're being led by sociopaths. They have no conscience, and the destruction that they've done on the planet is enormous. And then you look at different, you know, an Adolf Hitler, different dictators. There's a whole lot of folks that have caused some real harm. And when most people are trying to have a decent life and raise a family and not go running around and hurt other people, to me, to come to a place like you did with this guy, there's lots of us that would like to be guided to how you make that kind of breakthrough my handwriting analysis teacher, she liked to use the phrase, when someone was really upsetting to her, she would just say, there was someone that you just wanted to give them the black pill.
The black pill?
Yeah, the black pill, which I guess is sort of like, you know, to have death come knocking at their door for them.
Right.
To me, you know, that would, I don't think I'm the only one that, has been more than a little upset at the state of affairs of the corruption in our government and the governments of the world. I mean, just all kinds of stuff that's way out of balance. And so for you to make that breakthrough with that man with the pancreatic cancer, that's to me another theme for us to make a breakthrough, because biblically it says, judge not lest you be judged, and that, and before you criticize that little flaw in someone else, stand back long enough to notice that you got a few of your own.
Thank you. And that says it in a nutshell. With this particular man, you know, it was, in fact, I hesitate to use the word easy because I don't want to suggest I'm some sort of saint. But what happened is I got it, you know. I mean, I got it. He called me to his bedside, and he was in terror. And I know pancreatic cancer. I've been a nurse a long time. I knew what his prognosis was. And he was terrified of dying, and in fact, he would die soon enough, which he did soon enough, you know. And my concerns at that point were trivial. It was a matter of not life and death, but death and death. He was going to go, and he knew it. And, you know, obviously, if I were in a parallel situation, if I had pancreatic cancer and was in a hospital bed and was woke up in the middle of the night in a panic, I would certainly want somebody to approach me with calmness and kindness. And so it was easy once I was able to. It was a matter of simply dropping it. And I have to say my practice as a Buddhist has held me in good stead as an RN, because simply dropping it, dropping my judgments, dropping, getting off my high horse. And the concerns about the horror of what's going on in the world, I entirely share, of course, obviously. I've written quite a lot about it.
Well, thank you. That certainly helps to let us know that, like, ties back into that Indian thing of really be present with someone else's circumstance for 3 moons or about 90 days.
Yeah,
to really. Before you go off, it's like,
yeah.
Oh, okay. So, how tortured he must have been, knowing what he was doing and not being happy. For instance, from some of my studies, that the pancreas, one energy around it deals with location and laughter. So, if a person doesn't feel like they're in their right place, or with the right people or the right work, there won't be much joy in their life, this laughter, and the pancreas gets out of balance, and of course the cancer of the pancreas is probably the ultimate out of balance place of it. And so it was just interesting for someone to have spent their life in chemistry figuring out all these ways to do that stuff, and for their pancreas to go, for my studies, would be an indication that, no, they really weren't happy doing that, but they didn't have the support to break free of it.
Mm.
And then the system that finally went out was the one that was trying to tell them, look, you're not happy, you're not in your right place.
Yeah, exactly.
So now when people are going to want to go to Michael Ortiz Hill and get your book. What are some of the things that you think the reader is going to learn when they go through this?
Well, I think, I was just interviewing Dr. Kirsten Gemeiner for the second edition of the book, and I taught her the craft of compassion. She teaches alongside me now occasionally. And she said her revelation with the craft to look at compassion as a craft, as a learnable craft, was a revelation for her as an MD. Because she's, number one, she's very pragmatic, and she's very left brain? She's very rational,
Yeah.
And the idea that you could go into the details of the craft and that there is a structure of what one can go through. I think that would be my deep hope, that people would read it and step forth with that. To learn the craft.
Okay. So, and you don't have to reach true spiritual enlightenment to get benefit from your book and be a little more compassionate?
Well, true spiritual enlightenment. I'm a second generation Buddhist. My father was a Zen practitioner, and Soto, tradition, Japanese Zen, they say enlightenment is a given. You don't earn enlightenment. The more you try to earn enlightenment, the more you'll confuse yourself. You are the natural mind is Buddha mind. So, and the natural mind is compassion. We get forever distracted from our natural mind. We all know that. But it's not about being enlightened. It's about resting in your nature.
Ah. Well, that's, boy, that's worth the price of the book. Just
yeah.
knowing that. We don't have to go out and get it somewhere.
Yeah.
You can't go online and order it or download it. It's already part of you.
Yeah. Well, the Judeo-Christian Muslim point of view is we were born in God's image, and God is the quintessence of compassion. That is the image of who we are.
Mm. Well, that's kind of nice. Apparently, I don't see the writings of like God on a shopping spree.
What a terrifying thought! God on a shopping spree. I hope God buys my book at least a few copies.
Yeah. There you go. That's what we want.
There's a couple of million copies. You pass them out.
Oh, wonderful. Well, now, I guess from your experiences in different things, I guess there'd be a couple of areas. Certainly, when the title being, you know, at the bedside of the ill, and in a way, I don't know if the correct term or one term for it is wounded warriors.
Oh yeah, yeah.
In this life experience, there's precious few of us that were born into, went through, for instance, precious few that went through a gestation in the womb where
uh-huh.
the mother was having wonderful feelings for 9 months and
mm-hmm.
kept sending us messages both through her thoughts and through the umbilicus in the chemicals mm-hmm. that life was wonderful.
Uh-huh.
Hardly anyone, you know, got that on a constant basis. And then the birth process for most people was not anyone's idea of a lot of fun. I mean, unless, of course, yeah, you know, I mean, you know, getting drugged up so he didn't know which end was up, and then having someone smack you a good one to try to wake you up from the stupor that you were, you know, drug-induced stupor. I mean, those are, you know, and then the modern times where the C-section is become so fashionable,
uh-huh.
and then just being raised into a culture where there's so much stress and conflict. I mean, they talk about, you know, just walking through this life with so many people with unresolved wounds or pain or hurts.
Yeah,
you know, and so to me, I guess there's any things that you can share that would help support us to, you know, things from your book that would help us to make some breakthroughs in that, you know, to being a little bit more compassionate with ourselves and each other, given all that we've been through.
Yeah, well, exactly, that's it. You know, this may or may not be relevant to your inquiry, but I was... I got an email from an old friend who I used to work, in fact, again, on oncology at UCLA Medical Center. Exquisite nurse. I mean, she carried such kindness for people who had cancer. And I got an email, and she said, her empathy has fled her, and she feels cold inside, you know. She feels if people can't get it together and try to fix their lives, then there's nothing she can do. And I emailed her, and I said, well, you know, your spiritual practice is feeling empathetic towards those who feel like their empathy has dried up, because you know what that is. How do you work with your own wounds so that they connect you with a wounded humanity and one is responsive to a wounded humanity? When I was recovering from multiple sclerosis, I was very taken with the stories of the wounded healer, and I said, what is the wound of the wounded healer that I bear now? You know, and what I got was, there is a way to self-infatuate with one's wound, to get narcissistic, me and my wound. But the sacred wound is the wound that connects you with the wounded world, and so that you're responsive to the wounded world. And that, you know, that's what I hear.
Yeah. Ah, okay. Well, so we can look kind of at what's going on in our lives, and go, oh, okay. So that ties back into my pain is my teacher.
Exactly. Profoundly so. Yeah. Precisely it.
And then to realize that, okay, I'm sitting here hearing the expression, no one has got it as bad as I do.
Exactly. Well, I know.
No one hurts like I do.
Exactly. Well, that's
and then
common delusion.
Yeah, and then you go, well, wait a minute. it seems like one of the nicest things that can happen is people get together and get acquainted. If it's a safe environment, they start to realize that we've all been through far more than we thought we could ever endure, and the good news
is we could
endure it. We're still here to talk about it. If we couldn't endure it, then we wouldn't be here talking about it.
Yeah.
And to me, that's such a sweet lesson to reach that breakthrough and get that empathy of, oh, you've hurt too. Oh,
exactly. That's beautifully put. You know, in Zimbabwe, the understanding in the Ngoma, the water spirit tradition, is when I first arrived in Zimbabwe, I had most of the symptoms of water spirit disease, including one is a kind of empathy that incapacitates you. It's like you don't have any skin. It's not a useful empathy. You're incapacitated by it. And the only healing for water spirit disease is to be initiated as a medicine man in the Ngoma, the water spirit. So you make an alliance with the spirit that afflicts. It's not like Western medicine where it's you make war on cancer, you make war on water spirit disease, make war on whatever to make war on. So I came back from Africa, and of course I was pretty well immediately diagnosed with multiple sclerosis. And I recognized this also was a spiritual illness. And I had to make an alliance with the spirit of the disease to heal others, which is what I did with the water spirits in my initiation. So that's, you know, whatever afflicts you, and it can be physical sometimes, but it's not always, you know, it can be simple, a heartbreak. It is, you make an alliance with it, and you don't reject it. God knows, you certainly don't make war on it. The Ngoma tradition is both a peacemaking tradition and a healing tradition. The water spirits are the spirits of peacemaking. And the first thing you do is you make peace with the spirit that afflicts you. You make peace with the disease that you have been born to.
Wow. Well, with that thought of how to make peace, our time has completed, and I just want to thank you, Michael, because we feel like we're just beginning, and God bless you and your work. Go to see his work, michaelortizhill.com, and thank you, beloved listeners. I just appreciate you so much.
Okay. Well, thank you, Kevin.
You're welcome. Until we meet again, God
Indeed.
Bless, and goodbye for now.
Okay. Blessings to you.